Hello, and welcome to the Expanding Eyes podcast, and to our ongoing discussion of Shakespeare's romance, The Tempest, one of the great Shakespearean plays. We were looking at a great deal of exposition that has to be packed into the first act of The Tempest. It's one of Shakespeare's shortest plays, actually, a play so short that the action and the running time very nearly coincide, as critics will point out. But Shakespeare pays for that observance of the neoclassical unities through the use of a particular device that comes with a cost. The romances, unlike the comedies, transpire over a long span of time, an entire generation in each case of the four romances, where the comedies, which resemble them, and the romances can be considered in some ways an outgrowth or an evolution of the comedies. In the comedies, the resolution takes place in a relatively short period of time, if not the 24 hours that was posited by the Aristotelians, at least in a fairly short compass. But the romances, although they too come to a happy ending for the sympathetic characters, nevertheless have to do it through a long ordeal or set of ordeals that transpires over an entire generation. In The Winter's Tale, there's a 16-year gap right in the middle of the play. Shakespeare eliminated that in The Tempest by having the gap take place before the play begins. But what that entails then is that Prospero has to give a long lecture to his daughter Miranda that takes up much of the first act, simply in order to inform her, which means to inform us, of what happened in the backward and abysm of time, famous line from the play. And what happened was that 12 years ago, Prospero was Duke of Milan. But unfortunately, a rather irresponsible duke, because he didn't really want the job. He was, as he said, for the liberal arts without a parallel. These being all my study, he says. I gave over the actual running of the kingdom to my brother Antonio, which turned out to be quite a bad move, one which Prospero would spend the next 12 years thinking about and regretting, because Antonio either became corrupt or was corrupt in the first place and now was given an opportunity to act upon it. And Antonio did. He struck a pact with neighboring ruler Alonso, and they deposed Prospero and put him in a small boat with his three-year-old daughter, Miranda. 12 years have now expired, and therefore we can deduce that Miranda is now 15 years old, on the verge of womanhood for Shakespeare's time. And yet she was only a three-year-old child, and it was basically an act of murder because it was considered to be impossible that they would survive in this small boat all alone. And they would have died except that the good courtier and counselor Gonzalo, whom we've already met and had a favorable impression of in the short storm scene of Act One, Scene One, the good Gonzalo managed to smuggle Prospero's books into the boat. Well, okay. You know, this is the liberal arts major here, and there's the joke of, you know, what books would you take to a desert island and so forth. But that actually is not the real point. These are magic books, and Prospero is a magician. And if you are going to take books to a desert island, you should take magic books so that you can use the magic to create a pretty comfortable sounding existence for them while they've been here for half of a lifetime. Therefore, 12 years have passed, and suddenly, by the kind of significant coincidences that happen in romances, because a romance is a tale of wonders and marvels, and therefore implausibilities mean nothing to it. It's part of the game. And it just so happens that 12 years later, the boat containing the court party, the people who exiled Prospero, just happens to be on its way back from a wedding, and Prospero uses his magic to blow up a storm. The boat appears to capsize and split. Really, it's a magical illusion, and Prospero has disposed the various members of the court party in certain significant groupings around the island, and is going to begin to work on them, shall we say. He is going to create something out of his entire kingdom has basically been transplanted to this island, or at least all of it that matters. And he is going to work on it and remake it using the power of his magic. And he has to explain all of this to his daughter, who is homeschooled of necessity. The bus definitely doesn't stop here. And the liabilities of being a teacher, as Shakespeare may have known, because there is a possibility that he did some school teaching for a time in the so-called lost years of Shakespeare between Stratford-upon-Avon and his early references to his early career in the theater in London. He may have been a school teacher. At any rate, he knows how students can act, especially when they're 15, and builds it into the scene as jokes and a way to lighten it up a little, all this backstory exposition. He keeps saying to Miranda, "Now, are you paying attention?" And finally, sure enough, she falls asleep at the lecture that has gone on too long. There are indications, Prospero at least pretends, that this is part of his magic and he's hypnotically produced this. But nonetheless, by the end of this long explanation, Miranda is sound asleep for a while. And Prospero then has to get to work. He puts back on his robe and of power and takes up his magical staff of power and calls his two magical helpers, Ariel and Caliban. And here we have to stop. Our own backstory risks getting as sleep-making as Prospero's, but there just has to be so much exposition in order to go forward in this play. We have to stop for a brief digression explaining the Renaissance theory of magic, which Shakespeare is using. There were, in the Renaissance, two types of magic recognized. We would call them black magic and white magic. Black magic is the kind of more familiar traditional magic that deals with demons and evil spirits that are conjured up for evil purposes, and you'd better make sure there are no holes in your pentagram or the demon will devour you alive. That sort of thing. But there were also good magicians, and the good magicians drew their power from what was called natural magic. There are powers in nature. The Renaissance is on the verge of discovering science, and science becomes aware that nature is more than just stuff, more than just matter. It is also energy. It is also process. There are powers and energies in nature, and the magician can call upon them for good purposes. purposes. And to the more liberal humanistic spirits of the Renaissance, this was held to be allowable, not in violation of any tenets of the church. There were conservatives that did not agree with that, but some very famous Renaissance humanists definitely endorsed the use of white magic. One of the greatest of them, Marsilio Ficino, even wrote a whole book about it. And this is what Shakespeare is drawing upon, as Spenser does in The Faerie Queen as well. We have good magicians and bad magicians like Archimago, all the way up to people like Tolkien with Gandalf, other good magicians, although there the natural part of it has rather receded. But in the Renaissance, the powers of nature were, first of all, elemental powers. The four elements, earth, water, fire, and air, had spirits that personified their energies. And Shakespeare's version of this is Prospero's two servants, which he now calls in to do his bidding now that Miranda is asleep, Ariel and Caliban. Ariel comes in first, like clockwork. Ariel is associated with the two upper elements of air and fire. Air, through the very name, which is drawn from the Bible, but not, so far as I can see, for biblical purposes, but simply to do exactly that, to suggest the reference or the connection to air. But also during the storm scene, Ariel has been associated with making the type of lightning called St. Elmo's fire. So air and fire, the upward and the intangible elements. And Ariel is the spirit that Prospero likes. Prospero has a very double relationship with his two servants. Ariel has to be controlled, and every so often, mildly threatened, but only mildly, because Ariel is a delicate spirit, as he's once actually called. And Prospero and Ariel get along. They get along like Prospero is, as I say, on one level a teacher, and he has many teacher associations, one of them being you have different relationships with different types of your students. And it's always a relationship of power, but a good deal of warm friendship can develop in the good relationships with your students, believe me. And Prospero and Ariel, as we see them together over the course of the play, it is clear that although Ariel complains and bitches constantly about being put upon, it is clear that these two are fond of each other and that their final parting is going to be a little bit bittersweet, because they will part, because Prospero is able, Ariel is delicate enough to be able to respond to positive enticements, not just threats and coercion. And the positive enticement is liberty. Prospero here reminds Ariel what he has apparently already struck a deal with about him, and that is that if he performs Prospero's commands faithfully during this last final project, he will achieve his liberty, and, spoiler warning, he does. But they are a good working team, you might say. The other servant, not. Caliban. Caliban is associated with the other two elements, the heavy elements, the less noble elements of earth and water. In line 317, Prospero, who just about always, he's unable to address Caliban without something insulting in it, refers to him as thou earth. And Prospero is not a noble-looking character. He is also associated with water through being, apparently, perception is rather equivocal on this island, and different things look different to different people, and that includes Caliban to a degree, but to some he seems to be part fish. Prospero's name is an anagram of the word cannibal. This is well-known critical stuff about the play, and it's known for sure by the scholars that that anagram, there's no reference to Caliban eating human flesh in the play. Why a cannibal then? Because it's a reference, pretty definitely, to one of Shakespeare's favorite authors, and in fact to one of mine, the French essayist Montaigne. One of the examples of Shakespeare's signature that we have is on his copy of Montaigne. And Montaigne has an essay called Of Cannibals. And what that essay does is to say that, okay, you probably don't want to buy a cannibal cookbook for your mom for Christmas, but nevertheless, despite rather regrettable dietary habits, cannibals, Montaigne says, are not just what the age would have called savages. They have virtues that we supposedly civilized Europeans sometimes lack, even though we pride ourselves in being superior to them. We have to keep that in mind as we read The Tempest, because that allusion makes clear that Shakespeare is aware of that type of stereotyping and that type of resistance to the stereotyping on the part of Montaigne. Because it's easy to take Caliban as the author's own colonialist stereotyping of the native peoples, that the Europeans were, as Shakespeare was writing, traveling now all over the world, including the New World in the Americas, and meeting native peoples everywhere they went. And as a matter of fact, the theme of the New World is also definitely in The Tempest. As they say, a lot of backstory, because this short play has packed an enormous amount into itself. There is very definite reference through certain phrasing to not only the New World in general, but to a specific 1609 published tale of a shipwreck in the Bermudas, in which some of the crew became castaways, surviving for a number of years. There's a direct reference in one part of the play. Shakespeare seems often to be almost prophetic in certain ways, but never more so than in The Tempest, where he seems to have anticipated, foreseen the whole bitter history of imperialism and colonialism that was beginning in his time, though just beginning, and would burgeon eventually into the British Empire and all the other empires and lead to all the problems that we have in a post-colonial world today. Shakespeare can already see the problems shaping up, and they are problems of power and problems of attitude. And as I say, Prospero is never favorable to Caliban. He says at one point, whom any print of goodness will not take. And it does not take us all that long to see that that is much too simple a judgment of Caliban. He is not in every way an admirable character, by no means. He tried to rape Miranda, and part of Prospero, we have to grant, part of his anger is that he has not forgiven that, and it's the angry father, quite understandably outraged. But nonetheless, this is also supposed to be a wise man. And Prospero simply lacks, he's got a blind spot, it would appear, about Caliban. For all of his knowledge and all of his self-knowledge in the play, Caliban always seems to be the one blind spot, but that does not mean it's Shakespeare's blind spot. Shakespeare is quite aware that there is more to Caliban than that, and we will see that too. He is, however, primitive in the sense that would have been understood in Shakespeare's time, meaning that he is uncivilized. He is, in fact, an example of the early thinking when the social sciences were beginning to develop and free themselves from religious assumptions and take a quasi-scientific look at humanity itself and human nature, eventually developing into disciplines like sociology and political science. They began speculating, and they knew that human nature was a strange and difficult combination of nature and culture. We are animals and come out of nature, and in some ways we remain animals, but we are also in a different way. We have outgrown nature, and we have created ourselves partly free of it through all of the various thought processes and inventions that we call culture. And we are an interplay of nature and culture. And therefore, in order to think about this, they did what Einstein called a thought experiment. They began to imagine, okay, what would a human being be like if we subtracted culture or nurture and imagined nature without nurture? A human being who was only natural and not cultured at all. And that was called the natural man. Theorizing about this, by people like Rousseau, turned out to be very influential in the course of things. And Shakespeare is doing part of the thinking here. And also in King Lear, where someone who can be compared with Caliban is poor Tom, who is in one way simply a dramatic role being adopted by the character Edgar. But poor Tom is totally a natural man, much more so than Caliban. But Caliban is nature without nurture, it would appear. And he does live up to the demeaning stereotypes of native peoples. He is crude. He has a great deal of trouble with impulse control of all sorts. And he is also superstitious religiously. He worships a god named Setebos. He had a mother named Sycorax, who was a witch, and she taught him the worship of a savage god instead of the good Christian god, Setebos. Robert Browning has a marvelous dramatic monologue called Caliban upon Setebos. Caliban musing about religion, and this is natural religion. It is the religion that the natural man could come up with without Christian revelation. So Caliban is the natural man that Prospero has discovered here on the island. Both Ariel and Caliban are natives to the island, and this does bring in the theme of colonialism, and again, Shakespeare foresees this. The great story about the great ideological tale told by imperialists is that they come for the good of the people that they take over and bring them the benefits of civilization. The white man's burden, it was called during the days of the British Empire. We're doing you a favor, though you may be too ignorant to know it. And there was often sincere attempt to do good by Native peoples, but at other times it was sometimes conscious, sometimes unconscious exploitation, all the way up to and including slavery. And Shakespeare is aware of the abuses that are going to take place. Prospero, to his credit, tried in the beginning to genuinely treat Caliban well and to civilize him, took him in to his own dwelling place, and taught him to speak. But it didn't take, it didn't go well. And the conventional attitude would be, well, that just shows you, you know, it's difficult to civilize a savage. Yeah. Can you take the savage out of the subject? Now that we are in a post-colonial age and the other side is finally allowed to speak, we realize it looks a little different sometimes from the other side. At one point, Caliban says bitterly, "For I am all the subjects that you have, which once was my own king." And he's right. By what right does Prospero just land here and take over? By what right? There has been an awful lot, possibly too much in a way. The amount of it seems to swamp other concerns about the play, but an awful lot of criticism in the last 40 years or so from a neo-postcolonialist perspective looking at these issues, quite rightly so. And the bitterness of the sheer colonialist coercion, and the other bitter line, "Well, you should be grateful I taught you language." "Yes, you taught me language," Caliban says, "and my profit on it is I learned how to curse." As I say, looks a little different from the other side. At any rate, he has to be coerced, but he is coerced, and both of these servants must help Prospero in his task of remaking the court party, which means to remake his kingdom, which will then be imported back at the end of the play to Milan. And it begins at the end of Act One with the first member of the court party who has been sequestered all by himself, and that is Ferdinand, the prince who is the son of Alonso. And the passage in which Ferdinand finds himself on this island alone has given rise to a good deal of influence through the sheer beauty of the language, which includes what is possibly the most famous song in all of Shakespeare. And makes us realize that, yes, we are here in a romance, not just a tale, although it is the same context of thought as something like Robinson Crusoe, where it is not that Robinson Crusoe is entirely realistic either, but it is still within the realm of realism, and it is in fact often cited as the first realistic novel. Another shipwrecked castaway who meets another native, Friday, and again the meditation upon the natural man and upon colonialism and the dangers of colonial power. Enter Ferdinand, the stage direction goes, and also enter my favorite stage direction in all of Shakespeare. Enter Ariel, invisible, playing and singing. And Ferdinand cannot see Prospero, and Miranda is the additional stage direction supplied by David Bevington in my edition. But, you know, enter Ariel, invisible. How are you going to do that as an actor? Well, visible to the audience, of course, but it means not to the other characters. Nevertheless, it still doesn't make sense because while he's invisible, he's also supposed to be dressed up as a water nymph. What is the point of this when no one except maybe Prospero can see you, but it's don't ask, don't tell sort of thing. It reminds us of Fest in Twelfth Night dressing up as a clergyman to torment Malvolio, and Maria says, why are you doing this? You've got him in complete darkness. He can't see you anyway. But I guess it's method acting. He had to get into his part. Here, Ariel comes, invisible, and sings two songs. The first is Come Unto These Yellow Sands, and these songs here and in other Shakespeare plays have all been set to music by many famous and not so famous composers. And the island is haunted by music, by harmony, the inevitable symbolic metaphors made out of musical terms throughout Shakespeare, throughout the whole of the Renaissance, also in Spenser and Milton, harmony and discord. And here it's an island of magic, an island where music, people hear music, and Ferdinand hears the music. Where should this music be? In the air or the earth? It sounds no more, and sure it waits upon some god of the island. Sitting on a bank, weeping again, the king my father's wreck, this music crept by me upon the waters. Haunting lines of Ferdinand, quoted by T.S. Eliot in The Wasteland. And then follows the most famous song probably in all of Shakespeare, and probably the most simply haunting. Ariel sings, full fathom five thy father lies, of his bones are coral made, those are pearls that were his eyes. Nothing of him that doth fade but doth suffer a sea change into something rich and strange. Sea nymphs hourly ring his bell. A breathtaking, mysterious song. And yet, a lie. It's not true. Ferdinand's father is not dead. Ferdinand's father is Alonso. Ferdinand thinks his father is dead. And this will lead him further into that assumption. So therefore, we have Prospero via Ariel doing quite a bit what the Duke did as another one of what Fry calls deputy dramatists, people who within the play act as deputy dramatists, puppeteering the other characters as a kind of a dramatist inside the play. And there is a lot of resemblance between the Duke of Measure for Measure and Prospero, including this business of meddling with people's lives, which includes letting them think things that are not true and would be very upsetting, as the Duke allows Claudio in Measure for Measure to think that he's about to be executed the next day. He's going to die. The Duke has no intention of allowing that to happen, but nevertheless allows Claudio to live in the terror of it for some time. Here, again, the fear of death, but the death of the father, the grief of Ferdinand over a father that he thinks is dead, but who in fact will, in a sense, come back to life. His father is not under the water, and yet, on a non-literal level, he is. He is under the sea because the sea, on a non-literal level, is symbolically death and chaos, as it is in many works, not just in Shakespeare in the Renaissance, but all the way back to the Bible. The sea of death and chaos. And Alonso has allied himself with a very evil man, Antonio, and allowed himself to get sucked into a murderous act. And as we will see later, he feels extremely guilty about it, to the point where he is having what we would call a nervous breakdown over it. So he is covered with the sea of death, chaos, and madness. And all of the island and all of the inhabitants are symbolically underwater, and Prospero, by recreating this society, will raise it like Atlantis out of the sea. Therefore, the song does fit. It simply has to be read symbolically rather than literally. And Prospero allows Ferdinand to see his daughter Miranda. Here is a young man alone on an island, thinking for all he knows he's the only survivor, grieving for a father he thinks drowned, but then hears magical music and sees a very attractive young woman. And she sees him. Prospero allows this. Miranda looks upon Ferdinand and says, "What is it? A spirit? Lord, how it looks about. Believe me, sir," addressing her father, "it carries a brave form, but 'tis a spirit." And goes on to say, "I might call him a thing divine, for nothing natural I ever saw so noble." Poor Miranda, she's always rather smugly laughed at for being naive, but it most certainly is not her part. She is utterly smitten at first sight with Ferdinand. And you can say, well, yes, she's 15 and hormones and all that, but she's looking for love as we all do. And let's grant her, this is the third male she's seen in her life. The first one was her dad, and the second one was Caliban. There ain't many people on the dating site. And Ferdinand is no doubt good looking. He is equally smitten with her and says, "Oh, you wonder." And that's a pun, because Miranda's name literally means wonder. "No wonder, sir," she says, "but certainly amazing." Prospero says in an aside, "It goes on as I planned." He will pretend to be the irate cynic's father out of New Comedy, but in fact, his first act of rehabilitating his island is to be a matchmaker for his own daughter. And we will follow the fortunes of this couple and the others next time.